You're listening.
Lo que escuchas, Fawn Radio.
Gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. On this program, I am going to I'm going to talk about something that was suggested by a listener, someone who heard an earlier program in which I was talking about the War of 1812. The American participation, the participation by the newly formed United States of America in the Napoleonic Wars. And what exactly happened? The War of 1812, remember that was the year of La Pepa, right? The Spanish Constitution. That was the year of the beginning of, well, just the year earlier, the beginning of Mexican independence, of all sorts of things happening at that time as a consequence of the Napoleonic Wars. Well, in America, things were, well, coming to a head. King George from 1805 to 1815 had the forces of the British Crown working against Napoleon's France. Now, Napoleon had as a goal, a dream, a maritime invasion of England. And so you can imagine the level of paranoia, the level of mutual animosity. One key British strategy was a blockade against France and a blockade against maritime commerce with France. But of course, the colonials, the ex-colonials, people in the United States who actually could not have become independent without French help, they were eternally grateful to the French and didn't stop trading. In addition to which, you know, because of the blockade and so forth, all of this was enormously lucrative. Yes, the French, Napoleon's people, they were paying very, very good money for commerce and for pretty much anything the United States could give to them. Now, Britain reacted by seize, asir o engautar in this case, engautar. Britain seized ships, cargo, and men. Remember that the British, at that time, for military purposes, they had the right to impress. That meant there were press gangs going around, and if people were needed on a ship, if there weren't enough seamen, if there weren't enough sailors on a ship, then the people in the ship were authorized to go around to different ports and simply kidnap people. It was legally possible to kidnap. And this was called impressment, and it was considered temporary. It was considered in the best interests of His Majesty and again, perfectly legal according to the Maritime Code. The Admiralty had been doing it for generations. So yes, press gangs walking around trying to get people to join the Navy, either by inviting them for a drink. And of course, when you wake up after that drink, you are on shipboard and you have been sequestrado. You've been kidnapped. Well, Britain seized American ships, seized American cargo on the suspicion that they were going to be traded with the French, and seized American personnel. The Merchant Marine, which was large at the time, or the Navy, which was also fairly formidable at that time. Well, the Royal Navy put those captured sailors into British service, and this was considered too much for the United States. President James Madison asked Congress for a declaration of war, and Congress gave him one. Now, this, of course, is strange in a way, because since then, the United States has fought in war after war. But even though theoretically, according to the Constitution, only Congress can declare a war, the wars that America has fought in have been undeclared. Now, you can imagine that the border with Canada was going to be natural for some kind of skirmish, for some kind of conflict. Canada, at that time, had filled up with people who, at least initially, had been loyal to the British Crown, living in the 13 colonies, living in the future United States, but the patriots there had made life impossible for them. Many had gone to England, but many had gone north to Canada and were living in Canada, and there was no love lost between Canada and the United States at that time. The border battles were continuous. Better call them skirmishes, right? Escarmuzas, not battles. But still, on the coast, you had Navy warships and you had private ships, privateers, but again, the British had numerical superiority, of course, and technological superiority. They had the great ships of the line, the enormous warships, and the United States had absolutely nothing to challenge that. So yes, it turned out that the big, let's call it the trigger, what initiates this conflict, is going to be an American incursion into Canada. If you ask people from the United States about invading Canada, they will say, practically all of them will say, it never happened. America has never invaded Canada. Relations between Canada and the United States have always been perfect. We love Canada. And of course, if you ask the same question to a Canadian, the answer will be quite different. The answer will be, of course, that relations between Canada and the United States have always been tense, and Canada has been subject to American incursions and invasions on multiple occasions. There were three major, major conflicts. But of course, remember that the perpetrator has no reason to remember what happened. The victim has every reason to remember what happened. So yes, the version that you will get from an American and the version you will get from a Canadian diverge. In any case, in 1813, U.S. forces burned down the capital. Today it's called Toronto, but back then it was called York. This included the Canadian Parliament. So yes, Britain, of course, could not allow that to go unpunished. And the punishment was going to have to be, exemplary. But still, yeah, things had to wait until Napoleon had been defeated and was in exile. By 1814, Britain was ready. Britain had a certain affection for its ex-colonies. There was a great deal of affection, certainly in Parliament, if you can believe this, before, during, and after the War of Independence. Many people thought that this was a regrettable error, a tragic mistake, that at any point it would have been avoidable. But still, time had come to teach a lesson. Sir George Cockburn, who had no love for America, Cockburn landed General Robert Ross and his troops, there were 4,700 of them, at Benedict, Maryland. This was very, very close to the District of Columbia. It was about 40 kilometers from the White House itself. So yes, here we are at Benedict, Maryland. You've got 4,700 British troops. How to respond? President Madison tried to organize a defense, but at that time, there was really not a lot he could do. The entire history of the beginning of the United States had been a conspiracy on the part of the individual states to deprive the central government of its ability to raise funds, to have a decent army, all of this sounded very, very much like tyranny to the minds of individual Americans and especially the state legislatures. And so, as I probably mentioned on an earlier program, Washington, D.C. itself is located on a horrendous piece of land that nobody else wanted, with enormous humidity and this kind of semi-tropical condition where malaria is endemic. And this is what people wanted. Anybody interested in participating in central government, in a federal attempt to vertebrate the new United States, anybody who participated in such activity should be punished by having to live there. In any case, President Madison, who had no funds, who had no real ability to react, was trying to do his best to react. His wife, Dolly Madison, was busy trying to organize the White House for a retreat. She wanted to get out as quickly as possible with as much of their property as possible. So, the Minutemen, who were there as a militia trying to guard the United States, they took up their post. And, well, unlike during the time of the American Revolution, this guerra de guerrillas, right, this guerrilla war of sharpshooters, francotiradores, sharpshooters, using the natural landscape against British troops, all of that had actually worked much, much better during the Revolutionary War than it did at this point. Perhaps because it was the middle of August. Perhaps because you can use the natural advantages of the bad weather of winter against these troops. But during summer, they're ready to fight a decent battle. So, yeah, naturally, everybody tries to blame things on everyone else. To blame, echar la culpa. In English, contemporary English, today we say, we call this the blame game. I blame you, you blame me, everybody blames somebody, nobody blames themselves. This is pointing fingers at everyone. The blame game. So yeah, Washington, this is not going to be the last time, Washington begins to play the blame game. And the consensus was that it was the president's fault. Now, because order, civil order, began to break down, there was chaos and violence in the streets, and people took advantage to loot, to saquear, to loot the shops, steal whatever they could, take advantage of the fact that people were running away from this armed invasion. The British entered Washington, D.C. completely unopposed and systematically began to set fire to public buildings while scrupulously respecting private property. So yes, they set fire to the Navy, to the shipyards in the Navy, the astilleros. They began to burn down the Capitol and, of course, the Senate chambers. Then they headed toward the White House. At the White House, they found food was still on the table. In other words, the president and his wife had had to run quickly. The officers ate the food. Then they helped themselves to the wine cellar that had been so scrupulously accumulated and maintained by Thomas Jefferson, who himself was a great connoisseur of wine. Well, they helped themselves. They indulged in the very best of the bodega, of the wine cellar. And then they burned the White House to the ground. After this, they decided to go to the city of Baltimore. And the city of Baltimore began to resist. The British attacked, first by land, and then by sea. There was a fort in the middle of the harbor, Fort McHenry. You can see a reconstruction today. Now, they bombarded that fort throughout the night. And the following day, you could still see the flag of the United States. And somebody being kept prisoner who was a witness to this bombardment and the fact that the flag was still there the following morning, he wrote down a poem dedicated to the this action of defiance, the resistance of Baltimore. Later on, this poem was adapted to music. It was there was a popular song at the time, and somebody decided that the poem could fit into this popular song, that you could sing this poem using the same melody as the popular song. It doesn't really work. And besides, it was a drinking song. But that's how the Americans' national anthem came to be. The American National Anthem, Oh Say Can You See. Oh Say Can You See. It has many different changes in register, and they say that fully one-third of the population does not have the vocal ability to hit all the high notes and all the low notes. And there are moments that are very, very sort of awkward, moments of torpeza total in this, that there's the lyric, Oh Say, does that star-spangled banner, right, bandera cuajada de estrellas, does that star-spangled banner still wave? Sigue ondeando? It's a question. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? But because the drinking song and the poem don't really come together very well, you have to do something like, Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? This is really awkward. And of course, the American National Anthem has never been particularly well loved. There have been many, many attempts to use alternate songs and choose them as a national anthem. In any case, this was Francis Scott Key writing about the resistance of Boston, or rather, I'm sorry, the resistance of Baltimore. So, the British, in the end, after Napoleon had been put away, and the British were sort of eager, right? Tenían como afán. Estaban ansiosos. They were eager to put all this behind us. They agreed to leave U.S. ships alone, not to impress the soldiers, not to seize, incautar, the cargoes. But, well, in the United States, this idea that a militia, a people's militia, Minutemen, were going to be enough, began to change. All right, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
To the right radio. You're listening to Vaughn Radio. You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
Vaughan y Víctor Ullate sumaron sus décadas de experiencia en la enseñanza del inglés y en la formación de danza y artes escénicas para crear un campamento único que ayudará a los participantes a desarrollar todo su talento artístico.
La Escuela de Danza y Artes Escénicas Víctor Ullate cuenta con más de 30 años de experiencia en la formación de danza clásica, danza moderna y artes escénicas. Junto con Vaughan hemos creado una inmersión lingüística a través de múltiples actividades, juegos, talleres, de manera que los niños en el campamento no solo se formen y demuestren su talento, sino que se sientan también seguros y muy cómodos con el idioma.
Buscamos fomentar la faceta artística y creativa de los niños a través de una formación especializada en el mundo de las artes escénicas en un entorno angloparlante, donde pierdan el miedo a hablar en inglés y utilicen el idioma en su vida cotidiana mientras se divierten y desarrollan su potencial. Son las últimas plazas. No dejes pasar esta convocatoria. Campamento Vaughan con la Escuela de Danza y Artes Escénicas Víctor Ullate. Infórmate en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
Empecé con 2 metros cuadrados durante los primeros 9 años de esta empresa. El espacio físico de la misma consistía en 2 metros cuadrados en un rincón de mi dormitorio con ordenador, impresora y teléfono fijo. Ahora son casi 8,000 metros cuadrados, 180 aulas en varias ciudades del territorio español.
La empresa era una mesa, una máquina de escribir Olympus con una pantallita donde mi padre pues escribía todos sus libros y lo que hoy en día se conoce como el método Vaughan. Vaughan empezó en casa, cogíamos nosotros el teléfono, yo me acuerdo de pequeñita que sonaba el teléfono de casa y así, claro, mi madre siempre corría detrás mío como diciendo, ay Dios, que ha cogido la niña el teléfono. Sí, un momento, papá, y así es como empezó. Yo fui la secretaria de Vaughan de esa manera desde muy chiquitita. Mucha gente piensa que Vaughan ha salido de la nada. Como, ¿quién es este Richard Vaughan que de repente tiene radio, tiene tele, tiene un método, se ha forrado? Pues no. Han sido 40 años de lucha, sacrificio y haber fallado, aunque él dice que nunca ha cometido un error. Vamos a ser sinceros. Y alguno ha cometido, lo que pasa es que él no los llama errores, los llama microcorrecciones de volante, ¿vale? Y que cada vez que se ha equivocado en algo le ha servido para aprender y para salir más fuerte.
Más de 40 años de esfuerzo y dedicación en los que hemos tenido la suerte de contar con la entrega de grandes profesionales con un objetivo común, una enseñanza de calidad. GrupoBaugan.com. Estás escuchando.
You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
You're listening.
Baugan Radio.
Estás escuchando Baugan Radio.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughan Radio. All right. On the first part of the program, I was talking about the War of 1812, a part of the Napoleonic Wars, as they were experienced by the recently formed United States of America after independence, what it was like, and how people began to dream big, and, well, yes, expansion toward the West. Benjamin Franklin, in Paris, as ambassador, talking about the different conditions for peace to be negotiated with the English, he said that independence was not enough. On the negotiating table was the idea that Great Britain could give the United States money for Canada and the Floridas and Bermuda and the Bahamas and the West Indies. Not only that, Benjamin Franklin told the British negotiators that he could take Ireland off their hands if they wished. In other words, he was thinking big. He was negotiating big. Of course, none of this came to fruition. The United States, although much of the southern colonial culture in a place like, South Carolina, a place like Charleston, all of that coming from Barbados directly, many of those people from Barbados, the way of life, Barbados, South Carolina being Barbados number two, all of that looking toward the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, but without any real possession down there. In any case, it was only a couple of generations later that the United States decided to provoke a war simply to gain the advantage with the newly created state of Mexico. Mexico because of its, Texas rather, because of its resistance to the Mexicans had achieved de facto independence, could not be admitted as a state to the United States without either being recognized as a free state or as a slave state. This would upset the very delicate balance then existing. And so the United States, for a while, ignored Texas. Texas looked around as an independent republic, thinking who it could join up with, maybe the British? In any case, in the end, the United States decided it was ready to recognize Texas as a state, and Mexico was furious. Not only that, the United States unilaterally decided that the border was going to be much further south than had been mentioned earlier. It was going to be all the way down to the what the Mexicans called El Rio Bravo, and what in the United States was known as the Rio Grande. Now, all of that, in pure provocation, that sparked the Mexican-American War, which Mexico lost after Mexico City was taken. And under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, California. All of that. This idea of manifest destiny, which was floating around at the time, from sea to shining sea, that all of that was eventually going to become part of the United States. Now, believe it or not, one of the people most enthusiastic about this conquest, this land grab, right, tirar y correr con la tierra, this was Karl Marx. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels loved the fact that this land now belonged to the United States rather than Mexico. Probably one of the reasons that Marxism has never really prospered in Mexico, because he insulted them. He said that, was it really such a misfortune that glorious California has been taken from the lazy Mexicans who did not know what to do with it? Yeah. Language like that cannot be forgiven easily. In any case, Engels said that in the interest of its own development, Mexico should be placed under the tutelage of the United States. Now, there are many Mexicans who would say that is just exactly what happened under the dictatorship of Porfirio Díaz, the Porfiriato, 40 years of exploitation by the United States, when a third of the economy and about a third of the land owned indirectly by people from the United States. In any case, American expansionism across the West and into the Pacific. Well, there were dozens of senators who simply wanted to use this occasion to annex Mexico entirely. Whether that would have been militarily doable, no, factible, feasible. Well, that's another question. But still, the prospect of annexing Mexico was played with even from the beginning. I mean, Alexander Hamilton served as George Washington's Treasury Secretary, and he had George Washington's ear, and he was one of the great Mexican adventurers. His enemy, the man who killed him, Aaron Burr, was quite ready to launch into Mexico and take it over. John Adams, the second president, said that Hamilton was crazy, absolutely stark mad. But, in the end, 10 years after Texas had won de facto independence from Mexico, in 1846, the United States finally recognized Texas as a state, the Lone Star State. This 10 years, this decade of independence from anyone, including the United States, this symbolically is sort of entered into the spirit of Texas. The Texans are by nature very contrarian, and they look on the federal government of the United States with a little more suspicion than other states do. And it is somewhat curious that, well, somebody like Thomas Jefferson, the third American president, his entire life was dedicated to the idea of the gentleman farmer, right? Somebody on his own estate, somebody on his own plantation, somebody living sort of as the Enlightenment, right? Ilustración. The Enlightenment embodied, even though he would naturally have a sort of self-sufficient plantation economy with slaves. But yes, this idea of a natural aristocracy as gentleman farmer, this idea is completely incompatible with the kind of expansion that he was talking about later in life, when Napoleon decided that it was untenable, unsustainable, to maintain French contact with Louisiana. First of all, because of the revolution in Haiti, the revolution in Haiti meant that French presence there would be practically impossible. And France, between the new United States and the Mexican Empire, they didn't actually know how to sustain it. And besides, Napoleon had other priorities in Europe. And so he simply sold Louisiana to Jefferson. And although Jefferson didn't have the authority to say yes, and certainly didn't have the money to say yes, Jefferson said yes. Jefferson wanted more. Jefferson wanted to attack Canada and take Canada during the American Revolution. As I mentioned on the first part of the program, Canada was always considered a kind of a fifth column, right? Because loyalists, people loyal to the crown from the United States, many of them just left and moved. Many of them were forced to move to Canada. And once they were there, they resented their ex-motherland, the country the Frankenstein that they thought had grown up in the United States. Jefferson wanted the Floridas. He wanted Cuba. He, during his last days as president, his only great interest was in expansion. Now, it was Henry Adams, in the year 1869, who wrote This is just after the American Civil War. So the whole continent of North America and all its adjacent islands must fall under the control of the United States. This is a conviction that is absolutely ingrained in our people. Yeah, the idea, again, manifest destiny, a sort of conquest by right, by divine right, by providence. Now, expansion within the continent happened relatively quickly, especially with the railroads being built. And so this idea of being able to live on the frontier and being able to have your own land there cheaply, all of that was actually starting to go away toward the end of the 19th century. Toward the end of the 19th century, the last decade of the 19th century, especially the invention of the alambrado, right, a barbed wire, that began to change things entirely. Large sections, ranches, were being fenced, cattle could not go freely. And the frontier was pretty much closing down. The last vestiges of resistance on the part of the indigenous Americans, that was pretty much a thing of the past. And so, this idea of expansion led, inevitably, to the Spanish-American War. The Spanish-American War, which, of course, ended up with the annexation of Puerto Rico, of Guam in the Pacific, of the Philippines, and Cuba. All of that met with considerable resistance. There were an enormous number of American intellectuals who were entirely against expansionism. And very, very influential senators and congressmen arguing against. In fact, the annexation treaty, the Treaty of Paris in 1898, the Treaty of Paris actually passed by only one vote. And so the fact is that there were many, many people at that time, an increasing number of people, arguing against expansionism. And you can imagine, if that's true on the elite levels, then on the level of the common people, well, during the American Revolution, during 1776, in the dark hours, you know, Congress, who really didn't have the authorization to be able to raise funds, they were giving out this these IOUs, these promissory notes, right? Fiduciario, idea that we will pay you back in the future. And this, it was given out, but only a very few people would actually honor this and treat it as if it were moneda curso legal, right? Legal tender. No. And besides, it was very easy to falsify. I mean, you could forge one of these things very, very easily. And many people did. During the American Revolution, almost as many inhabitants of the colonies fought for the British as for the Continental Army. There were 8,000 patriots in all fighting under George Washington, and 7,000 locals fighting for the British. George Washington's troops had no blankets. They had no food. They had no shoes. They had no guns or ammunition. But not because it didn't exist, but only because people refused to trade with him. Didn't have anything, money to pay for it, and people preferred to go up to Philadelphia or New York or any place under British occupation where they could get a better price. Now, on the first part of the program, I was speaking of the sort of the continuation of this during the Napoleonic Wars, the War of 1812. The British Army arrived, almost 5,000 troops arrived and marched on Washington. Well, what did they eat? They ate American food. The local farmers were only too happy to trade what they had to the British because the British paid well. And of course, without this food, the logistics of what they were doing, selectively burning down the public buildings in Washington, D.C., that the logistics was untenable. They could not have been able to do it. Naturally, the president at that time, Madison, couldn't do anything. He didn't have enough men to fight and didn't have any money to pay them with. There were, in theory, 500,000 militiamen on duty, but only about 35,000 of them ever put on uniforms. And the inducement, the incentive to put on those uniforms was monetary. Otherwise, they would not have done it. During the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln asked the states to produce volunteers. Now, everybody knew that this was not the way to get a good soldier. General Sherman, William Tecumseh Sherman, the one who is going to march to the sea and break the Confederacy into two parts, right? The great villain in Lo que el viento se llevó, right? The one who destroyed the city of Atlanta, burnt it down. William Tecumseh Sherman said that asking volunteers to come from the various states is like trying to put out the flames of a burning house con una pistola de agua, no, with a squirt gun. President Lincoln, in the end, had to oblige people to come under conscription. So, in 1863, the Enrollment Act required all males to register for 3 years of war. In New York City, the reaction was complete destruction. Complete destruction of federal buildings, complete destruction. And then, of course, they believed that the people responsible for all of this were African Americans. New York had all sorts of free African Americans living there, and the uncontrolled crowds decided to burn their property, kill and beat as many as they could find. And there was no way to restore order. It was 4 days of unparalleled violence. in resistance to this conscription. Now, the fact is that it was possible to pay $300 and escape this conscription. And Grover Cleveland, at the time, Grover Cleveland, who was going to be president of the United States, decided to pay this money with local funds. So that instead of getting 300,000 troops, the Enrollment Act got only 150,000. And 3/4 of those 150,000 were substitutes, paid. All right, I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Este 25 de marzo, en Madrid, Masterclass con Richard Vaughan en la Casa del Libro de Gran Vía 29. Reserva tu plaza. Es gratuita. grupovaughan.com/eventos-vaughan.
¿Y tú? ¿Qué nivel tienes?
Yo, intermedio alto.
¿Ah, sí? A ver, traduce esto. Esta es mi grapadora.
That is
this.
This is my
stapler.
This is my stapler.
Eso es. Y esta es la mía.
And this is the mine.
¿Cómo que the mine? Eso significa la mina. Lo que decimos es, this is mine, sin the.
Adiós, es verdad.
Ay, ay.
Esto es nuestro pan de cada día. Alumnos que creen que tienen un nivel intermedio alto y en realidad...